I'm sure there's some of you here like me who's been a longtime reader of the New York Review of Books, or as we sometimes describe it, the New York Review of each other's books. The latest issue has an ad from the Johns Hopkins Press, some of its publications, and it's entitled Confronting History. I think if there's a new development in the last generation, it's students who are realizing something I never quite realized in my youth, that you're assigned a history book and you sort of read it, you're thinking you're reading history. But now we've come to realize it's not an exact science. History is colored by sometimes patriotism, sometimes exceptionalism, sometimes, you've had that feeling. I was with a group of students the other day. We were talking about this question, and one of them said the latest book he had read is a book that he was recommending to all his others entitled Lies My Teacher Taught Me. So we have to be a little more careful about history now. What James Farwell has done is give us the history and culture of Pakistan without any moves in one direction or another. He's not trying to make a case. He's just trying to provide the opportunity to get some understanding of the troubled history and culture of this country, particularly in the last few decades. And that's a very important book right now, as many Americans see this debate going on, see those who talk about the humiliation of withdrawing, who also talk about the task we're trying to accomplish. So I think James Farwell has done a great public service in providing this particular book for us. If I understand what Henry Kissinger is saying to us in his newest book about China, it is to spend a little more time understanding the history and the culture, particularly of places which we're going to get engaged. I talked to a friend the other day who was describing his experience as one of the first people called into the State Department when the war in Vietnam was just beginning. And I said to him, first of all, in the team put together, was there anybody who spoke Vietnamese? Well, he said, no, that took a little while to find someone. We didn't really have that for a while. And I said, and what about some books about the history and culture of Vietnam? Well, he said, as best I can remember, there were none in English in that period. So this, again, is both a timely and important service to all of us, particularly, as I say, the public will be trying to figure out this debate and comments that go on. Some of our military officers with experience on the ground have gotten in a little trouble by speaking about this, but there's nothing more important. History matters, and as Sam Huntington pointed out 20 years or 10, 15 years ago, culture matters as well. So I thank James Farwell for providing us with this opportunity. I think it will become more and more timely as the months move on. If I can't jump off the platform,
no.
Look at the stairs. I'm tempted to try.
Thank you, Joe, very much. Thank all of you for coming. If I could ask one question, is Zahid Hussain by any chance among you here? He had emailed to say that he would come. I hadn't met him, and I just wanted to meet him. I wanted to thank, first of all, CSIS for their graciousness in asking me to visit with you all today. CSIS occupies a very fond heart in me. Much of my work is with the U.S. Special Operations Command, and we do a lot of outreach to think tanks, and none occupies a greater prestige that is well-earned than this think tank. And so I'm very grateful and very honored to have the opportunity to be here. I also want to thank Joe Duffy again publicly, because Joe has not only been a mentor but has been, again, incredibly generous and gracious, not only with his insights but in writing a foreword that's probably better than the book is. But in any event, the book was really a great deal of fun. I remember when I finished it, I then said, this is, it's done. And so I sent it off to Sir Richard Gerloff, who had been head of the MI6, and to Lieutenant General Dale Daly, and to various people, and said, here it is, can I get a script? What do you think of the book? They said, this will be a great book, now rewrite it. And so for anybody that has the ambition to write a book, let me warn you that it turns out there's a little bit more involved in it than some of us would like. I need to say to you all, and this is the one thing that I want you, if you remember nothing else, this is a fine Christmas present for you. It looks great on a coffee table. Sam Dorrance, my publisher, got a great designer. So even if you don't like the book, it looks great on a coffee table. I'm by background a lawyer, and please don't hold that against me. I'm a recovering lawyer, and a political consultant. I've done campaigns here for Congress, for governor, for the U.S. Senate. I was the executive director of John McCain's ad council in 2008, which doesn't mean much because he didn't listen to us. Although I'm not formally a part of Newt Gingrich's campaign, I advise him informally. He's been a longtime client since he was speaker, and I have done presidential campaigns abroad. And since 9/11, I have devoted increasing amounts of my time to working with the Pentagon in various of its aspects. I feel very honored to have had the opportunity. Sir.
I have to interrupt to remind everyone that he also has a play that will open in a few months in London as well, and some years ago a movie.
That's if you come to London. It's a screwball romantic comedy and has nothing to do with Pakistan. But since 9/11, I've had the honor of being able to work with special forces in other parts of the Pentagon, and it's an amazing group of people that work for these institutions, and I have had a great time doing that. But with my background in politics and in law, I'm interested in a general sense in how political players use communication in order to compete for power and to consolidate their grip on power. One of the things that I've learned in doing 30 years of politics, whether it's here or in Korea or Greece or in other places, is that what political figures say in public and do in public in terms of understanding the political dynamics of a place is actually much more important than what they may say or do in private, and you can learn really a lot about it. And so it's through that dimension that this book is written. There have been a number of really wonderful books. Zahid Hussain has wrote a terrific book. Newsweek reporter Anatole Levin has wrote a great one. Pamela Constable, various other people have written wonderful books that have enormous merit and tremendous insight. But they look at things, and this is a good thing, not a bad thing, but my perspective is somewhat different. I'm somebody who is from a political background. I'm interested in how politicians compete for power and how they use communications to do that. I became interested in doing this book because I was fascinated by Benazir Bhutto. I thought that she was a very interesting person. She was interesting throughout all of her life. From the time that she was at Harvard and at Oxford. At Oxford, she was quite a celebrity. She was the first Asian woman to become president of the Oxford Union, I was at Cambridge, and we it's a problem for Benazir that she went to such a second-rate university, but one has to forgive people for certain things like that. But to be elected the president of the Oxford Union or the Cambridge Union, are you Zahid Hussain by any chance? I have to pay homage to you. Zahid was most gracious. I recognize you from your photograph. I need to just say this. In doing this book, I was lucky enough to get great interviews from a lot of people. Zahid was incredibly gracious to grant me one. I want to pay homage to the extraordinary book that he has written, Scorpion's Tale, and was pleased to see that his view on Pakistan was similar to mine. He might say he's pleased that mine is similar to his. But I did want to say thank you not only for your book, which adds immeasurably to the discourse on Pakistan, for its clarity, for its insight, for the exceptionally well-written prose that you provided. And if everybody reads my book, you should read mine first simply because I'm up here and I get to say that. But you should also read his. And I will also say this, that I talk to a lot of people on and off the record, and the number of people who volunteered that Zahid was one of the top two or three reporters anywhere in the world in covering Pakistan is something that, if you did not know that, you should know that your peers hold you in the highest esteem, and I feel humbled to be even talking in the same room with you. So to return to Benazir, so she, from her earliest years when she was a student, this was a woman that was very determined and had a sense of herself. She, it's not by accident that she entitled her first book A Woman of Destiny, or Daughter of Destiny. She saw herself very much in those terms. And at Oxford, it didn't keep her from being somebody that would put in her nose into everybody's politics. I mean, everybody says, well, what are Americans doing in Pakistani politics? The first debate that she was in Oxford was one on American politics, in which she made the statement that George Washington made his career because he couldn't tell a lie, and America has a president in Richard Nixon who can't tell the truth. So, and she was just as adept in sponsoring resolutions of the Union saying, resolve that this house would rather rock than roll. And so she had a lively sense of humor, and I knew lots of friends who knew her, and they were all unanimous in their account of her as somebody that was completely fearless. And I think it's important to point this out because, and let me just say that what I'm going to do in these remarks is just offer some of the insight, few of the insights that I drew from my own research in writing this book. But one of the things that struck me about her, because it is a very rare thing in my experience in working with politicians from not only this place but other countries, to find somebody that actually has the guts to take on something in which your life is put at risk. It is very easy to dress up with the beret and to talk like you're a revolutionary. It's great, as we see all the time in internet discourse, that people preach the rhetoric of revolution. It is quite a different thing to move beyond cheap signaling like that and to actually put your life on the line. And one of the things that interested me about Benazir is that she did that, and one has to pay homage to that. She's all too human. I mean, I've been around politicians for most of my adult life, and they all have more than their share of human flaws. It is the notion of seeing somebody, a character such as you saw as the star of The West Wing, does not exist in American politics. Somebody said to me, boy, if only we could have a president like that. I can assure you that person does not exist on the planet Earth. Politics turns ordinary people into Frankensteins. That's just what the process does. Your jokes are funnier. Your insights are more profound. Everybody agrees with what you're saying. Everybody wants something from you. You feel 10 feet taller, and you feel that you are imbued with a sense of gravitas. Having been a political consultant, I would say that candidates all too often behave like children with power. And trust me, children with power are very dangerous. But it goes with the territory. Benazir is somebody who showed when the chips were down that she had what it took to stand up. The trauma of seeing her father put to death by Zia, once Zia realized that Bhutto, who I'm not a fan of, was going to be around and would continue to be a thorn in his side, was very traumatic. And yet Zia treated her with the utmost cruelty. The imprisonment to which Benazir was subjected is the kind of thing that horror movies are made out of. And she came through that. She came through it with the help of people like Ambassador Galbraith, but the fact that she survived it at all says something about the determination and the strength that she had. When she came back to Pakistan in 1988 to run for prime minister, she was only 35 years old. People our age think of people who are 35 years old as looking like they're getting ready to graduate from high school. And we sometimes forget just how young 35 is to run any country, much less a very complex place like Pakistan. And whether it was just pure chutzpah or stupidity or courage, the fact of the matter, she had the guts to go back. And she ran a campaign against that was opposed essentially by an intelligence service led by two very smart people in Hamid Ghul and General Begg and their cohorts, which demonstrated an imagination and a creativity that was really quite remarkable. If the Pakistani politicians used half that much creativity, on a day-to-day basis. Pakistan would be in much better shape than it is. But she was even cleverer than they were in being able to outfox them with an even better campaign. But the fact that she won it all at age 35 as a woman in Pakistan is something that I think is a great political achievement. As prime minister, she had many problems. She showed up in office and found that the office had been stripped, but was ingenious enough to collect the people that she could and go to London and get a tutorial on how to run a parliamentary cabinet office from the British, which I thought was an ingenious thing to do. She had a very mixed record as prime minister in her first term. The army was determined to get rid of her at every turn, and I think that it's very easy to be critical of politicians who don't accomplish everything that perhaps one might have hoped that they would do unless you really are dealing with the political realities that confront people in politics. I mean, look at our own politics. Without editorializing over things like the debt crisis, dealing with that is really difficult. There are really hard trade-offs. There are really conflicting feelings. And in a place like Pakistan, where you had very serious and fundamental differences between the political players, in a culture that's characterized by social conservatism, driven at one level by ties of kinship and power and family and clans and tribes and the entire cultural underpinnings within which any political player has got to deal with, it's very hard to get things done. She actually got more done in her first term than you would have thought. She was not able to repeal the Hudud ordinance or some of the other things that she wanted to do, and ultimately she's thrown out of office by the military at the first opportunity. When she came back for a second time, she was not as successful, and not surprisingly, was again tossed out by the military. All of you who are here, I think, probably know something about Pakistani politics, so one need not dwell on the obvious other than to note that in Pakistan, the real power in that country has been and continues to be held by the military. The most powerful position in that country remains the chief of army staff. And if you can't get along with the military, it is very difficult to do anything in Pakistan, even setting aside the difficulties of dealing with a conservative culture that is deeply resistant to change. The people who are vested interests in power, whether they are feudal aristocrats or a self-perpetuating urban elite, are not terribly interested in the notion of reform as we would contemplate that notion. And so Benazir was not, at one level, successful in her first two terms as prime minister. By 2007, she wanted to come back and, I think, try and live up to the potential that she saw in herself. And so much of the book focuses on how she used communication to set up a base of support in Washington, which was a base of support that Musharraf, whom she had to deal with and was the president, recognized as something that he had to contend with. At the same time, she needed to put her politics together to go back to Pakistan. The People's Party there certainly was in a good position to win elections that were going to be held in 2008. Musharraf had taken power in a coup, and Zahid wrote in his first book, Frontline, as well about that as anybody has, in which Nawaz Sharif essentially tried to force Musharraf's plane to crash. And he considered himself a liberal autocrat. He was initially very popular, but never held an election in which he could actually gain the kind of political legitimacy that defines success in politics. It's very difficult, ultimately, in government to be successful if you're not considered particularly legitimate by lots of people. And I think that's one of the things that plagued Musharraf. And I'll talk about Musharraf in a minute. But a good part of the book deals with how she and Musharraf used their communication to position themselves in order to be able to mobilize support for their ambitions. He wanted a third term as president. He would have liked to keep his job as chief of army staff and be president, which the Constitution prohibited and which ultimately political reality stopped him from doing. She wanted to be prime minister for a third term. And the problem she had was in two parts. First, she was term limited. And second, there were criminal charges that were hanging over her head. Neither she nor her husband were ever convicted of any crimes. She and her supporters would argue that anything that she did was lawful under Pakistani law. Her critics would say that they were corrupt. My book is not interested in resolving that. What I'm interested in is the political impact that the controversy had on their communications and how they had to deal with that in order to gain power. And I think there are lessons learned from that examination. Musharraf, to me, is also an interesting figure. I think that by his own lights, Musharraf was a patriot and an idealist. I think in the end, Musharraf really did want to do what he thought was right for his country. And there are lots of lessons learned from the way that he operated about the danger of somebody from the military trying to run a civilian government. Musharraf was, by all accounts, a very competent and certainly courageous soldier. He had had a good record. He obviously did his politics well within the military, which was its own self-contained world with its own self-contained standards and a great deal of pride. When he became president, he found what most people from the military find when they go into politics, which is that it is a completely different environment that you have to deal in. I can only think of three military people who left the military to lead a successful democratic society. One was Ataturk in Turkey, Eisenhower, and De Gaulle. There may be one more, but I can't think of one. It is not that easy to be successful in politics, and the mindset that most of the military people have really doesn't equip them to do very well in politics, which requires you to develop an agenda, to forge consensus, to mobilize support, to channel support in order to get things done. And in the end, that caught off with him. And I think it's fair, but again, I think looking at how Musharraf operated is very instructive, because some of the lessons that one can gain from looking at how he operated would apply if you were going to evaluate how Mubarak operated, how bin Ali operated, how Saleh operates in Yemen, even how Assad does. There are certainly real distinctions, but there are also lessons in common, and we could talk about that in a minute. But the two great things that I thought were interesting in looking at Musharraf's operation were how he dealt with the nuclear scientist A.Q. Khan and how he jockeyed for power with Benazir and then what he did in the wake of her assassination. In dealing with Khan, I thought that he conceived and executed a very adroit plan. The problem that Musharraf had was very simple. The United States was putting a great deal of pressure on Pakistan to stop trafficking in nuclear materials and to avoid proliferation. And that was something that Bush, who liked him a lot, was very insistent about. But the problem was that the military, I think the evidence shows quite clearly, was very involved in this program. The idea that Khan was a freelance operator is something that I don't think that the evidence supports. He was traveling with too large a staff. He was dealing with materials that would be very hard to get out of a sensitive installation. The explanations that were initially offered that somehow he was doing this in the middle of the night really don't seem very credible. And indeed, Khan himself has said that he always operated with the consent and with the knowledge of the government. And I think that what he says, at least on that particular point, and that, and he's backed up on this by the people that worked with him, I think is more credible. So Musharraf needed to isolate him from the media. And he did so through the device of house detention. And it was not quite as easy as one would think. To me, when I think about the nature, the bizarre nature of Pakistani politics, one might sum it up this way, and that is that a country in which a nuclear scientist, a man who created a nuclear bomb, becomes the equivalent of a rock star, becomes their Mick Jagger, says something about the political nature of a country and the security concerns that a country like that would feel about its neighbor India, about whom it has had long, deep-seated paranoia. And it also says something about the sense of national pride that a country like that has. But the fact that you would turn to a nuclear scientist for that instead of to another icon says something. Musharraf had to deal, though, with this reality that in order to silence Khan, he had to treat him with a lot of respect. And so the book talks about and shows how he dealt with Khan, and I thought that he showed an unusually a subtle and adroit a scheme of maneuvers in order to balance the interest of silencing him without alienating a Pakistani public that would have rebelled against any efforts to treat him in a way that the public thought was wholly disrespectful. And I thought that was very interesting. But what it says is that when the chips are down, any military ruler is going to do whatever it takes to protect their interest and our notions of due process be damned. And that's something that I think that we need to bear in mind when we deal, as this country does, with strongmen around the world, because this is a country that stands for the values of democracy and open society and good governance and effective democracy and any other name that you want to put on that. But it's important to understand that the mindset of the military is that when you do something that challenges the military in an authoritarian or semi-authoritarian country, they are going to react, and they're going to react very forcefully, and they are not going to be afraid to dissemble. Musharraf did not hesitate to dissemble with this country, not because he was by nature a liar, but because, as Winston Churchill said, nations have interests and not friends. And I think that that reflected his own mindset. I think Musharraf likes this country. I mean, he's raising more money than any of the Republican candidates for president, and I'm waiting for him to announce for president for Iowa. I mean, at the rate things are going, he could probably win. When he dealt with Benazir, on her return, it's now 2007, and again, I must, because he's here, commend Zahid for his really excellent history that also covers some of these events. She decides to come back in 2007, and in 2007, Musharraf has now been in power 8 years. Here's another lesson that you learned about politics. If you stick around too long, you start making big mistakes. You isolate yourself. Musharraf had absolutely no comprehension that I could see of the political realities on the ground, and it leads him into avoidable mistakes. The first one was a brouhaha that he got into with the judiciary. And there's lots that's been written on the judiciary and the system of justice in Pakistan, but my focus, and I think the thing that one wants to know, is that getting involved in fights that you can finesse is a bad thing in politics. And so this book describes how he did this and how I think he mishandled his communication. And you can see how his approval ratings, which actually had been very high, notwithstanding the fact that he was a semi-authoritarian leader, he did not have absolute power the way Assad has had in Syria, for example. And he was pretty popular up until the beginning of 2007. And his numbers start to nosedive as he gets into a fight with the judiciary, at the same time that he has to now jockey with Benazir, who has her own problems. On the one hand, Benazir is somebody who has a great name. She's one of a leading member of a family of the two major political parties, each dominated by a family dynasty, PPP by the Bhutto dynasty, PMLN by the Nawaz Sharif's dynasty. But there was lots of skepticism about her coming back. It wasn't quite the chip shot that some people make it out to be. And he, on the other hand, has now got to deal with the fact that he's term limited and now he's getting himself in all of these fights. I would argue that he could have finessed the fight with the judiciary and it would have kept his approval ratings from deteriorating. Starting in March and April, but particularly culminating in July, he gets into a confrontation with a mosque in Islamabad, the Red Mosque. One of the things I liked about Zahid's book is he came to the same conclusion I did, and not everybody who's written about it did, which is that I think that they had to attack that mosque and take it down. But what I was interested in was how badly he handled his political communication. And instead of putting together public support that should have turned something that needed to be done for the security of the state into a plus, into an ability to show that he was somebody who was a protector of Pakistan's interests, he blew it at every possible level. He had plenty of rationale for taking on this mosque, and he just didn't do any of the things that you would expect a politician in most countries. The idea that this is Pakistan and we don't do it that way is an excuse I hear from politicians all over the world, and it's nonsense. If you're going to do tough things in politics, you've got to identify constituencies that will support you. You have to mobilize bases of support. You have to show people that what you're doing is effective and that it's for the interest of the people and that it's the right thing to do. He didn't do any of these things, and so while they took down the mosque, they created a more virulent insurgency. And at the same time, he's busy negotiating with Benazir. And that negotiation results in a deal in which she agrees to have her party abstain on a vote of whether he would get a third term. She actually was intended to pull the rug out from underneath him later on and have another election. he passes something called the National Reconciliation Ordinance, which WAGS dubbed the National Robberies Ordinance, that gave immunity to Benazir and to her husband when they came back so that she could stand for Parliament. And there was an agreement, I think, generally speaking, that he would not oppose her effort to get a third term, providing she got the votes in Parliament. I actually think he didn't believe that she would ever get the two-thirds that she needed to amend the Constitution, and I think that had a lot to do with the way that he dealt with her. In the end, what we learn from somebody like Musharraf, and I think this is fair, a lesson that we can apply to any of these authoritarian regimes around the world, is that the insensitivity to the public, the notion that you really don't have to be accountable and responsible to public opinion, is politically fatal. And in the end, I think that's what happened to Musharraf. The most important thing, obviously, to Benazir in coming back was to have security, to protect herself. They wanted to bring in Blackwater to provide security, and Musharraf, for reasons that remain somewhat unclear, refused to allow that to happen. I think that from his point of view, he considered her a nuisance and thought that he had gone overboard to provide security. But the important thing is that people like this don't understand that if their enemies run afoul of assassination attempts and they die, the impact on their own political fortunes can be catastrophic. And that's really what happened here. She comes back to Karachi in October. She luckily survives an assassination attempt. I think it's clear that there were assassination squads that were tracking her. But ultimately, in December, she winds up going to the Likot Bog, which is a park in Rawalpindi, where she is assassinated. There is a lot of controversy and a lot of unanswered questions that are associated with that. And my book looks at this. And I do it, and I was trying to figure out a way to look at how somebody like Musharraf really view this. He doesn't like to give interviews on this. The interviews that he wouldn't give me an interview, unfortunately. But in all of his interviews, when he's talked about that, he's been remarkably consistent in what he has said. And so I was trying to think of a way to convey the way he did damage control and to deflect blame from himself that would try and capture a sense of Pakistani politics. So I created what I call a dictator's playbook, which has rules of the game from a dictator's point of view and how to do damage control and to deflect blame. And they're very caustic rules. And I then put on my lawyer's cap and I evaluated as objectively as I could the evidence of how well his strategies played out both politically and what the evidence showed in terms of who might have been responsible for the assassination of Benazir. I came to the conclusion, and I think the evidence, at least that's been made public, is very clear that Betula Massoud, who was a tribal militant, was not responsible for her death. It is hard to name the exact individuals, but to me it's clear if you simply ask the question of who benefits and who had the most to lose from her becoming prime minister, there are elements of the intelligence services that most likely were involved in the organization and planning of this assassination. It's very difficult to get proof because, of course, there wasn't really much of an investigation at all. The UN did an investigation that really didn't conclude much of anything that I thought was terribly useful. But again, I think that's something as you look at this, you will see in the blow-by-blow basis the way that Musharraf dealt with it or didn't deal with it. He had no concept of how to deal with this kind of a crisis any more than Ben Ali did, any more than than Mubarak did, any more than Saleh does today, any more than Assad does. Musharraf was just a somewhat more benign and liberal version of an authoritarian ruler. And so when you look at this playbook, think in terms of how other people might also deal with a situation like this. He was as bad in dealing with his communication vis-a-vis Benazir as he was good, I think, in dealing with A.Q. Khan. And in the end, he fails as a leader because of this. The final part of my book, and I'll just make a few comments on that, looks at Pakistan from 2008 to the present. And the thing I think that I would want to just say about that is that what's striking to me is the gulf that has opened up in the wake of the attack on bin Laden between Pakistani and American attitudes. America had said that we would track down bin Laden no matter how long it takes. And when we got him, Americans summarized the results of that mission in two words: mission accomplished. In Pakistan, there was a completely different reaction. Pew did a poll that showed that 55% of Pakistanis thought that killing bin Laden was a bad thing. For Pakistanis, this was merely the latest in what they perceived as a long series of slights, starting from 1965, when there was a view that we didn't provide spare parts to the Pakistani government in their conflict with India, to 1989, when, from their point of view, America left Pakistan to deal with 3 to 4 million refugees, refusal to sell F-16s in the late 90s because of anger over nuclear proliferation, the drone attacks, which have been a very significant political problem and threaten the civil stability, I think, of Pakistan as a state, and the events that happened this year, which were highlighted partly by the case of a CIA agent named Raymond Davis, who was accosted in a market, and I'm told I had very good sourcing on that. And he was not accosted by members of the ISI. He was accosted by two robbers, and he shot them. But the problem was whether or not he had diplomatic immunity, and his paperwork really wasn't in order, and it created a huge crisis. But the crisis, I think, in my explanation of it, is interesting to me because I use it to show how a culture of conspiracy tends to work in Pakistan. A lot of people talk about this culture, and I tried to show through looking at the public discourse exactly how one thing leads to another. And the assassination of the Punjab governor, Taseer, and the minister of minority affairs, all of these things became tied into it. Pakistan, it seems to me, is a country in which that has a very weak national identity. It's not optimistic about itself, and that tends to breed a culture of conspiracy. It tends to foster a sense of betrayal. It tends to create a sense of in which people blame external influences for problems that they have. And when you go back to the bin Laden case, from a Pakistani point of view, they were in a trick box. If they did not know that bin Laden was there, then they were incompetent. If they did know that he was there, then he was complicit. Put that together with the mounting anger, the explosive anger over the sense of breach of sovereignty and the patronizing attitude that they perceive America's had with its drone attacks, and you have a situation in which it's not surprising that the tensions between the United States and Pakistan are rising, and that some of us who've looked at Pakistan, and I, again, look at it as much as anything as a political consultant, and you really fear ultimately for the stability of Pakistan as a state. There's no great desire that I can see, and polling data, I think, bears this out very clearly on the part of average Pakistanis to have violent extremists take over the country. On the other hand, the things like the drone attacks are taking a toll on the credibility of the government. They're increasing anti-Americanization. They're giving more credibility to violent extremists and to Islamist influence and their effect on cultures. And it's, although I find myself that Imran Khan, the cricketer, is a very erratic politician and not the answer to Pakistan's problems, but actually I find in, oddly enough, that he's written as eloquently as anybody has on the danger of the drone attacks. And I don't think that Washington has really come to terms with what these dangers are. I think it is a much more fragile situation than we necessarily agree on. Just as I believe that in Pakistan, the elected government and the military have not done what they should do in getting together and mounting a campaign to delegitimize and marginalize violent extremists. And I think that this country is also missing the boat in not doing more to encourage stronger economic ties through trade. But when you put all of this together, what you see is a country that is very fascinating. I think that Pakistanis are a very talented group of people. It is an amazing country filled with amazing people that has amazing potential. It has many problems. It's corrupt, but on the other hand, one could say the same thing about India. In And by the way, if anybody wanted to go to Italy right now and talk about Berlusconi, it's somewhat hard to make the case that Pakistan is worse off in its leadership than Italy is. So that I think that one has to put these things into a context. It's important not just to view Pakistan as Pakistan, but that when you view it and evaluate where our interests are and their interests are, we have to pay attention to how they look at the world. We have to pay attention to what our interests are and their interests. And I think in doing all of these things, even understanding their culture and taking that for granted, how we communicate, how they communicate, what we say, and what we do, because actions matter as much in strategic communication as language does, really makes a difference in what the future will be. And I think that we need to look to the future with engagement, because it's important that we do engage with this country. But we need to do so with our eyes wide open, and we need to think ahead. And we should not be tied by some of the conventional thinking that we have been beset with in the past. So anyway, again, I just close with a reminder that this is a fine Christmas present for all of you. Anybody here who would like to buy 20 copies of it, my publisher, Sam Dorrance, is over there, and he tells me he'll give you a $1.50 discount on each new book that you get. But anyway, thank you, and if I can answer questions, I shall do my best, and thank you for listening to me.
James, go ahead. Good evening. I wanted to introduce myself. I'm Andrew Schwartz. I'm our Senior Vice President for External Relations, and I'm going to keep this discussion going. I know many of you will have questions. But before I do that, I want to point out that we're very fortunate to have Dr. Duffy here, who gave a nice introduction. I wouldn't be sitting here today, actually, if it wasn't for Dr. Duffy, and I really mean that. My parents moved here in 1969 from Philadelphia so my dad could work for Joe Duffy. So I owe a great deal of gratitude to this man. I would not be a Washingtonian without him. It's great to have everybody here tonight, and I think you just heard a terrific account of this excellent book by its author. One of the things, you know, we talked about James and all the, he's quite a Renaissance man, and all the things that he's done. We didn't mention that he was born and raised in New Orleans, and like me, he went to undergrad and law school at Tulane. So we're happy to have you here. I think you answered most of my questions, but I want to lead it off with back to the present. Recently in the news, Pakistan granted India most favored nation status. How much does this matter, and will it help diffuse tensions between these two nuclear powers?
That's a great question, and it would be my view that obviously the best way to stabilize that region would be for Pakistan and India to find some kind of balance so that the hostility could be diminished and hopefully resolved. It's my view that that is not going to happen by addressing political issues. There is no way that I can think of to resolve, for example, the dispute over Jammu and Kashmir. From an Indian point of view, they're not about to have a plebiscite. The Maharaja signed the instrument of accession in 1947. Under international law, that gets it, and India, from a legal point of view, is right. Second, it's a multi-ethnic country. India is not going to want to encourage other ethnic groups to lobby for their own independence. From a Pakistani point of view, the area is majority Muslim, and although a recent poll in Reuters suggests that if given a choice, Muslims might want independence from India, they don't necessarily want to be part of Pakistan. I just don't, and America cannot meddle in this. It is something we need to keep our noses out of. That's the wrong focus, in my opinion, for helping. Where we can help and where we can make a difference is that instead of focusing our resources on, for example, aid to a country that pays no income taxes, I think less than 1% of Pakistanis pay direct taxes to the government. I mean, the wealthy, they don't pay taxes. What we ought to be doing is finding ways to lower trade barriers between Pakistan and the United States, the United States and India, which we're already doing, but also helping them to find ways in which they can develop ties economically. Because where countries have strong economic ties, where there is a win-win situation to enhance prosperity, it just strikes me that there is a better opportunity for two countries that have had historic tensions between each other to be able to come together. I don't think any of this is easy. I don't
strikes me that the available possibilities, this is the one that impresses me at least as the most plausible.
First thing I want to ask you to do is flip on your microphone. It's right here, so on the inside of the component. Second thing, we're going to open it up after I ask one more question because this is an important one. Before his retirement, his recent retirement, our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen, called the Haqqani Group a veritable arm of the Pakistani ISI. For many Americans, this publicly confirmed what many suspected for a long time. Where does the relationship with the United States go from here for Pakistan?
Well, I think the first thing one has to do is to be realistic about what the different perceptions of interest are between the two countries. And I'm about to say, I think most of you know, so let me say this as quickly as I can. On September the 10th, 2001, Pakistan was a happy camper. As it looked to the West, it had in Afghanistan a government that was run by an Islamist Taliban that was Pashtun and that was pro-Pakistan and certainly not pro-India. In the wake of our taking out bin Laden and going into Afghanistan, it now confronts a government that from its point of view is a Tajik-dominated government with a Pashtun face that has recently entered into an agreement with India. So it's dealing with a government that it believes is pro-Indian, and that heightens the problem the paranoia that Pakistan feels about military encirclement by India. The nation of India on its east and Afghanistan with a pro-India Tajik government on its west. Let's not forget that Pakistan has a very sensitive problem. On the one hand, it has 35 million Pashtuns. And I don't think that any Pakistani government can pursue policies that fail to take into account the interests or the desires of a constituency that great. It would be like President Obama deciding to embark upon policies that African Americans find to be anathema. It just wouldn't happen. At the same time, they know that we're going to leave. Whether we leave next year or 3 years from now, the U.S. is getting out of Afghanistan. And it's my impression that the ISI at least believes that the Taliban is going to win. In politics, you tend to choose the winner. So I think that tends to motivate the assistance that the ISI is providing, apparently, to elements of the Haqqani network. From an American point of view, this is completely unacceptable, obviously, for reasons that we would understand. But you ask me what we do about this, and I think that, again, there's not an easy answer to this, but this is what I would suggest. Are some things that we can look at, aside from playing hardball, such as going to the Indian military and saying, if you don't rein in the ISI, then we're going to consider striking a military alliance with India in order to contain Pakistan militarily. We could do that, but you're playing with fire if you do that. It is something we may be forced to do, but I would hope that we don't have to do that. Cutting off aid isn't going to do any good. They could still tax themselves. Pakistanis are rightly a very proud people. They're not going to change policies that affect fundamental interests just in order to have more money. But this is what I think is important, and this addresses a broader spectrum of problems that you have in Pakistan. And again, let me be clear. I don't think there's any overnight solutions, and I don't want to sound glib about this. All of this is difficult. But one of the things that one, I think, must come to terms with is that I think that the ISI support for the Haqqani network enjoys a lot of popular support among people in Pakistan who believe that Pakistan is essentially fighting America's war. And so, in a sense, there is that anger. There is anger over the drone attacks and not a lot of sympathy in a lot of ways for America because they feel that Americans have caused a lot of the bombings and the instability that now afflicts Pakistan. There are people like myself who would say, yes, that may be true up to a point, but today this is also Pakistan's problem, and they have to deal with it. And I do think that they have to deal with it because it plays where it lays. What has not happened in Pakistan, and what has to happen, if anything is going to be done about violent extremism, is that the elected government is going to have to get together with the military, and they are going to have to mount on a comprehensive long-term basis what Americans would think of as an issue management campaign in order to marginalize and delegitimize violent extremism. campaigns work, and nobody shows this more jointly than the government of Pakistan. In 2009, when they went into South Waziristan, Kayani got everybody into the same room. I think Zardari helped put them up to it, or so I'm told. But regardless of who instigated it, it was Kayani who knocked heads together and said, it's them or us. And they put together a campaign to provide popular support to attack militants in South Waziristan. It was a well-messaged campaign. It was us versus them, them being the other foreigners. It was done in the name of protecting Islam. It was done in the name of fighting for the motherland. Kayani was very adroit in separating tribal elements that he thought were supportive of the government from those whom he thought were against it. And the important point is that attitudes shifted. And that kind of basic political approach to politics is not characteristic of this government. Zardari is very unpopular with people. I mean, we think of Obama here as being in deep trouble, and he is, with a 43% approval rating. How would you like to be a president of a country with a 10% approval rating? Well, that's Zardari. He's pretty good behind the scenes in cutting deals. He's much shrewder than I think people gave him credit for being. But he's terrible in terms of being a public politician. But unfortunately, when you're dealing with something like this, where the Taliban doesn't own up to bombings, they say that Israel, India, or the United States were involved separately or together. You've got to take steps that really mobilize the public so that they are genuinely hostile to that. I need to say, in all fairness, that doesn't mean they have to promote a pro-American agenda, because being pro-American doesn't necessarily mean that you are, in other words, you could be anti-Taliban without necessarily being pro-America. And I think the drone attacks there are just a huge problem in dealing with attitudes towards this country. And there we just have conflicting interests, and it's a different issue. But that's if you could do that, then you could shift the environment so that it would be more possible to be able, I think, to constrain the ISI. I think ultimately part of this campaign has to make clear to the Pakistani public that a successful Taliban in Afghanistan, which is Islamist, may not look benignly upon a government in Pakistan that is essentially secular and democratic, and that in point of fact, in the long term, that it does pose a threat. But that is an argument that Pakistanis need to make to other Pakistanis, and it is not an argument that we can make.
Let's open it up for your questions. John. John, we have a microphone right there, sir.
Hi, John McGaffin. Great talk. I did not come prepared to buy your book, but I will buy all 20 copies.
Sam, do you have a box back there? We do gift wrap.
I'm using John Hamry's money, so it's all right.
Oh, 40 copies.
You touched part of my question on your answer on the Haqqani network. And I like that, and the relationship. I wish I could feel that there was a chance to proceed down that road, and the communications approaches that you propose are very attractive. I'm still very skeptical that we can get there. So I want to take you back one more time to the core issue here, and that would be to the relative to Bin Laden, because I think the issues are related. What were the words you used? They were just inept, the Pakistanis, or they were complicit. That's sort of the breakdown. And I think if it's the latter, there are implications for this that go well beyond the death of Bin Laden. In many ways, I'm sort of reminded of the Iran hostage issue, where the United States did it for years, trying to figure out whether the government was in charge of the students. You know, it didn't matter. Look at where we are today. But my question to you is, if they're complicit, at least in my belief, the Army and ISI are not separable on this issue. Some would disagree. If that's the case, if they're complicit and they will go that far in the face of their relationships with us, I think it strikes me as a bridge much too far, perhaps too far, to get over if that's the bedrock.
Well, I would respond in two dimensions. Number one, if you're right, we should pull out of Afghanistan and leave, period. Andy Leslie, who's a lieutenant general, a three-star in the Canadian Army, and I had lunch some months ago, and I asked him what he thought about Afghanistan, and I am not an expert on Afghanistan, and I don't hold myself out as one. But I asked him, I said, what is your judgment about that? And he said, Jim, instead of thinking about what is the best result that we will get for success, ask yourself what is the least bad result that we will get. Now, if we accept your thinking, then one starts from there. Zahid has written in his book, one of the points that he makes, and it's a theme of his book, is and he makes it powerfully, in my opinion, is the impact on attitudes of the drone attacks. And I think he makes his points very cogently. I would just say that there is a conundrum there, and his conclusion is that we ought to negotiate our way out of it. My only problem with that is I'm not totally clear that negotiation is going to get us anywhere, and so I come back to this thing that we may very well be faced by that. But I think it's important in any country, and this goes for Pakistan as well, not to make the mistake of treating a country as homogenous. Within the military, and certainly within the intelligence services, it's quite clear that there are different elements. Let's take Benazir's assassination, and I write about this. On the night of her assassination, at 2 in the morning, the director general of the ISI, a guy named Nadim Tosh, whom this country pressured the government to fire because of his ties, we said, to the Taliban, showed up at her house at 2 in the morning to say, don't go to the park. I write about this, and I'll leave you to read the book to see my analysis of it. I will just, is there anybody from the media here? Are we on or off the record?
We're on the record.
Okay, well then, let me just say simply that when one writes a book like this, one has to deal with British defamation laws. And so some of the things that I might have said in this book, I didn't say. But I will say this, when you look at the evidence of what happened starting from that meeting until the end of that day, there are some very significant unanswered questions about, as Americans would say, who was on first. But I do not believe that Taj tried to do anything except to save her life. But I do think that the intelligence elements of the intelligence services, whether active or retired, were implicated in a very strong way. It seems apparent to me that Bin Laden, being an Abbottabad, had the knowledge of various elements, whether within the intelligence services or the military, most likely the intelligence services. There isn't any reason to believe that Kayani knew that, and I tend to believe that Pasha didn't know it either. I will say that, and I've said this to SOCOM, it would be interesting if somebody could interview Ijaz Shah and Hamid Ghul and a couple of other people and ask them if they could tell us, please, where Zawahiri and Mullah Omar are. And I think their responses would be very interesting to hear. But it is a mistake to tar the entire Pakistani military with that. The danger that would worry me about the Pakistani military is that I think that these drone attacks and the continuing bombings are inevitably going to alienate parts of the military, the intelligentsia, and the middle classes in Pakistan. Some of the bombers who have been responsible for attacks in Pakistan recently have not been uneducated people from dirty madrasas. They've been educated people. You have a very fluid and very dangerous situation there, in my opinion.
Question in the front right here.
Thank you. I'm Akbar Khwaja. I'm a World Bank retiree and a former senator from Pakistan. First of all, let me commend you on your effort addressing a very complex subject, and I could see in your title, I could hardly see any positive words, so that reflects how hot is the book, eh? My question actually is focused on one thing, and I'm not sure whether you have covered that. Pakistan, being a non-NATO ally, has sacrificed almost 35,000 people. They have become victims, because you were covering the story from post 9/11 or 2002 to until now. And the second impact on our economy has been $60 billion plus. And the aid that Pakistan got is just a fraction of that. I would like to have your comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a good. I make that point in my book. That I don't think that Pakistan, and this is rightly a criticism that Pakistani leaders make of the United States and Washington, that 30,000 civilians, 2,000 to 3,000 members of the military, 2,000 to 3,000 members of the police have died as a result of this thing. You hear different figures. I think Jelani said $35 billion has been lost to the economy. And I think that one, and this goes to a very important point if you want to collaborate with another country, and that is that everybody has a sense of pride. You know, as we all know, Thucydides all those years ago said that nations go to war out of pride much more than out of economic or military interest. And so I think that part of what's happened here in dealing with Pakistan is that Pakistanis feel, not unjustly, that Americans have been too patronizing. One of the things that I wrote about in this book that I thought was so interesting, it's a sort of a vignette, is that in this country, Charlie Wilson has been made into a folk hero, partly because George Creels is such a brilliant writer and Tom Hanks made an entertaining movie. But Muhammad Yusuf, is that how he pronounces the name, a brigadier general who was in charge of the Pakistani forces in Afghanistan, wrote about that. And it's fascinating to me. Most of the book is a very academic and very formal analysis of the military war in Afghanistan in the 80s. But the point that he made goes to what you're saying, and that is that Wilson, aside from the Stingers, would certainly change that war, was responsible for forcing the ISI and the Mujahideen to buy all these weapons, not the least of which was this Swiss machine cannon, which is on the cover of Creel's book, to buy weaponry that ate up a lot of money and was utterly useless in that war. And his point is, we knew the people, we knew the territory, and they just ran roughshod over us, people that didn't know that. And so I think that is a fair-minded criticism. On the aid question, I'll look you right in the eye, and this is what I'll say to you, that I think your country doesn't tax anybody. I mean, in our country, we're concerned about taxes that may be too high, but in your country, the wealthy don't pay anything. You have a constitution in which farmers don't pay anything, even though, 25% of, and I'm married into a family that grows sugar cane, so I know a little bit about this, that don't pay taxes. So this whole notion of aid, I think, has created an unfortunate dependency, and I think that it is an unjust thing for a proud and talented people. My book, I think you will find, is actually quite sympathetic in many ways to Pakistan, and I did my best to treat it with the respect that I think that it deserves. I'm by no means hostile to it. And my book is not ideological. I just called the shots the way I saw it from my point of view, looked at through my, you know, something that I do. I mean, what I do as a political consultant is I look at different cultures, and you can go to places, and I can read strategic situations. I don't have anything close to the cultural understanding that Zahid or lots of other people have who know Pakistan better than I do. But within my dimension of politics, I feel pretty confident about what I'm saying. So I look you in the eye and saying, Pakistan needs to stop being dependent upon foreign aid. It needs to take control and responsibility for its own future. And let me tell you something, you can do this. You all have the talent. And this nonsense that we have a conservative culture and who is ever going to overcome that, throughout history, we have seen culture after culture that thought that it was impervious to change only to see that it happened. It's my belief that had Benazir survived, had she become prime minister again, although as Brent Scowcroft, in another book I recommend to you, which is Kemp's new book on Berlin, 1961, said history doesn't reveal its alternatives. But when she was in Washington, she talked about an orange revolution being given for Ukraine. And it's my belief, and you can see this in the film that Mark Siegel produced, which shows clips of her addressing this oceans of supporters. I think she would have had no choice but to lead a real popular revolution. And I tend to have a lot of confidence, not necessarily in the outcome of revolutions, which are unpredictable, but the ability of cultures that are properly led and motivated to change. All the motivations in the world exist for Pakistan. There's too much talent in that country, and one wearies of Pakistanis saying, oh, we couldn't possibly do this because we're not good enough. Countries that have a sense of confidence in themselves, that are optimistic about themselves, can take control of their future. People like myself who are involved in American politics worry because I think we're at a tipping point, in which for the first time in my lifetime, I worry that Americans wonder whether we have the optimism and the confidence to deal with our future. And so that would be my response to that. It's a very good question. Your point is well taken, but I also give that back to you.
I really appreciate it.
Welcome.
If I quickly take a 10-second comment, this impact on economy is $60 billion plus between being victim, being part of that region. It's not a Pakistani estimate. It's a World Bank, IMF, donor agency estimate.
Yeah, so, I'm not quarreling with you. I just, Jelani said 30.
It's not on aid, actually, the impact.
Jelani is the one who used the $35 billion figure, and that speech was written for him by the military.
Let's move on. We're going to take one more over here, and I know all of you want to buy some books as advertised, and we'll take one right over here, and then we'll call it a night.
Thank you. My name is Malik Siraj Akbar. I'm a journalist from Pakistan, and I congratulate you over the publication of this wonderful book. Coming back to the point of President Zardari being absolutely unpopular, with 10% of popularity. I mean, it's of course disgusting to hear all this about an elected president. But where does this narrative come from in Pakistan? Like, I mean, I'll go back and it's a brief comment, then it will be followed by a question. Like, Pakistan is losing 30,000 people. Who killed them? Were they killed by Hamas or by Pakistani terrorists? By their own people, losing economy. Who develops this narrative? And like, Pakistan being a victim of American invasion, Israeli invasion. Similarly, Benazir Bhutto being labeled as someone who created the Taliban, Nawaz Sharif is the guy who stretched Kargil, and Zardari who sold Pakistan's integrity and dignity in the hands of Americans by embracing the Kerry-Lugar bill.
Do we have a question
here? So where does that come from? How was Benazir while dealing with the military narrative? Did she ever have a role while the country's foreign policy was devised, or was it the guys in the khaki calling the shots? Thank you.
You've really raised three things, and I can answer them quickly. Where did the narrative on the casualties for Pakistan and the loss of the economy came from? The answer is your elected government says that. Jelani, in his speech to Parliament after the raid, is the one who put that out. And Zardari himself has written an op-ed piece in the Washington Post that you saw. So if you ask what is the source of that narrative, it is Pakistanis. You asked me where did the narrative of Benazir creating the Taliban came from. That's a fact. At the time that this came up, the ISI was supporting, I can't pronounce these names, help me out, Gulbadar Hakmatyar. I can spell it, but
Gulbadin Hakmatyar.
Yes, they were supporting that. And at the time, the Taliban was seen in somewhat of a different light than they did. And Barber, who was one of her generals, came to her and said, we ought to try this. It has a better chance of stabilizing the place. She gave her support to it. Later, she said that probably wasn't the most foresightful of her decisions. But it's not something that I think is a debatable issue. Nobody ever made any doubt about it. You know, you ask where all these narratives come from in terms of Zardari's popularity. It's a function of the public polling that's been done. By the Pew organization. There's only one politician in your country that does very well in terms of polling data, and that's Imran Khan, and he lacks the political organization that is necessary to be elected prime minister or president in a system like yours, which is of indirect election. I don't know what would happen in a direct election.
I want to thank James Farwell for this fascinating talk, and I want to commend you for your work, and let you know that CSIS is proud to have hosted you tonight. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Thank all of you so much.
And we'll have books on